was an amazing experience for the simple fact that the building trades were all there, and they recognized the picket line immediately. And it was just a very historic moment.
When I'm driving on those streets and I hit pothole after pothole after pothole, potholes are not Republicans. Potholes are not Democrats. They have no party. But we can talk to our officials and say, you know what, we need to fill these. And that's what those ARPA funds can be used for.
The industry standard is voluntary recognition. When a majority of your employees in the media industry tell you they are union, industry standard is to recognize that. And MSNBC has refused to do that.
These issues of rail safety, of transit safety, these are not partisan issues.
By understanding how work is organized, workers can then understand why the technical composition was changed in order to decompose workers' power.
I've never owned a suit in my life, and I think the fact that I still work in the factory, it's easier to service the members when you're working right next to them on the factory floor.
Those early indigenous longshoremen stood up for each other. In 1906, they formed one of the first unions on the Vancouver waterfront.
Over the last 45 years, we the working people have been robbed to the tune of about $2.5 trillion a year. You want to talk about massive redistribution of wealth? That's it right there in practice.
Happy 4th of July weekend and welcome to this week's episode of the Labour Radio Podcast Weekly, where you can find out what's been happening within the Labour Radio Podcast Network over the past 7 days. Today's show really spans the full map of North America. To begin with, we'll learn about precision scheduled railroading at Union Pacific. Is it really safe for a railroad operator to employ a one-person crew on freight trains that can stretch to as many as 4 miles long? Sheet metal workers say no. Next, we head up to Oregon, where Painters District Council Local 5 has decided to walk out on strike for the first time in more than 40 years, launching what it describes as a summer of chaos. Then we head east to Indiana, where Nicole Bolden, the city clerk for Bloomington, describes the impact and the importance of the American Rescue Plan. We're going to check in on the Valley Labor Report in Alabama, where Jacob Morrison expresses his distaste for union busting at MSNBC. Professor Robert Overts joins Liz Medina and explains the meaning and the necessity of a workers' inquiry. Frequently featured on this show, this week Rick Smith switches from the role of interviewer to interviewee as he sits down in conversation with our colleague Evan Papp. We then travel to Albuquerque, New Mexico, where Michelle Ellis meets with Andrew Gutierrez, factory worker at Bimbo and the president of BCTGM Local 351. Finally, we'll end in where else but British Columbia, where we learn more about the Bows and Arrows, organized and militant indigenous workers who plied their trade on the BC docks in the early 20th century. We've got reports today from Talking Smart, Labour Radio on KBU FM, My Labour Radio, The Valley Labour Report, LRPN Profiles, the BCTGM Voices product, and On The Line, Stories of BC Workers. I'm Patrick Dixon for the Labour Radio Podcast Weekly. Here's this week's show.
You're listening to Talking Smart. The official podcast of the International Association of Sheet Metal, Air, Rail, and Transportation Workers.
This is Paul Pimentel, and I'm joined today by my co-host, Ben Nagy, from Smart TV Communications, and Michael Blaine from Smart Communications, who is producing this episode. This episode is focused on workplace and safety issues impacting our freight rail brothers and sisters. Our featured guests are Smart TD Kansas State Legislative Director Ty Dragoo and Smart TD Nebraska State Legislative Director Bob Borgensen. Both have been instrumental in helping to mobilize smart members and move state-level rail legislation. Bob, there's this process called precision scheduled railroading. Can you tell us a little bit about it for those who are listening that don't know what it is?
Yeah, Wall Street barked at them and Union Pacific jumped. They began this massive cost-cutting exercise that adversely affected non-operating folks, that jeopardizes the safety of our folks. The non-ops are much better trained in doing inspections of all different sorts that make sure that the equipment that our folks are running operates correctly.
Ty, are things any different out there in Kansas?
No, absolutely not. PSR is really the railroad's ability to commit the oldest sins in the newest ways. PSR has been devastating to our industry, not only because of the impacts we've had with membership, but the deregulations that have come from the model. PSR has created an environment where shareholders' concerns are becoming the front burners instead of what public citizens' concerns are, what safety laws are. This is our office, those yards, the cabs of the locomotives. We see the problems. But because the rail industry network is so large, it's taking time for the ramifications and recovering from COVID to see truly the devastation that PSR has caused industries.
Ty, you were able to do something that's considered pretty unique in today's day and age of partisan gridlock. You're in the state of Kansas, and somehow you were successful in getting the state legislature there to approve a two-person crew regulation. How was it that you were able to accomplish that?
Where this started with our success was actually when Laura Kelly, which is now the governor of the state of Kansas, decided she was going to run for state senate. And we met with her, talked about her issues. She was already very aware of some of the fatigue issues that the railroaders face. We decided to back her. For 10 years of talking about the issues, having her introduce legislation for us in the legislature, when she approached me and asked how we would be receptive to her running for governor, of course, we were all on board. And the benefit of that was when she won governor, we knew that our issue, two-person crew, would be on the front burner.
Bob, you focused your efforts working on both two-person crew legislation and long train legislation. What is the current state of your efforts there?
We did do a media campaign on two-person crew. We did television ads. We also did some social media, some social fencing. What it does is make sure that our ad is seen by devices that are within that fence. So pretty happy with that. We haven't been able to get the bill out of committee legislation. So fight continues.
Now, Ty, what are some of the strategies that you're employing?
Piggybacking on what Bob just said, the geofencing is a new frontier. This is something that we can target during our legislative sessions. I can set up a campaign within one city block. And it just so happens that our state legislature, our state house, is one city block.
What can we do to help both of your efforts out there for the transportation division deep in the heart of railroad country?
One thing, especially here in Nebraska, is we have to find a way to better communicate what the two parties mean to working people.
I think Bob hit the nail on the head. We have to explain to our members what the differences are between the two parties when it comes to labor issues. We don't care if there's an R, D, I, whatever next to their name. We care about our issues.
That's going to be the major strategy in order to get this, to fight against things such as PSR, against one-person crews. These issues of rail safety, of transit safety, these are not partisan issues, and it's going to take common ground and not this polarization in order to have any progress made against the industry and the practices they have decided to undertake.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Ty.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you, Bob, for taking the time.
All right, guys.
You're listening to Talking Smart. Mobilize, organize, unionize.
Do you have story ideas or have a question for the general president or union leadership?
Call us toll-free at 844-984-0947 with your questions or ideas.
Once again, 844-984-0947.
Portland.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Good evening and welcome to Labor Radio, of the working class, by the working class, for the working class. I'm Laura Wadlin, here with my co-host, Jamie Partridge. Hey, Jamie.
Hey, Laura.
Our guest tonight is Scott Oldham, Painters District Council 5 representative, here to talk with us about the summer of chaos. Hey, Scott.
Hey, how are you doing?
Great. Thanks for being here.
Good. Thank you.
So, on Friday, May 21st, painters picked up picket signs instead of spray painters outside the McDaniel High School construction site. For the first time in over 40 years, members of Painters Local 10 were on strike. Tell us what happened that day.
Yeah, that was it's called unfair labor practice. And again, yeah, like you said, it's been over 40 years. It was 1977 when we last picked up a picket sign. And we went out to a rather large project. It's a school that's going on with Portland Public Schools. And we went out there with our unfair labor practice. We had approximately 15 workers out there. And then plus some, we also invited other members to come out that morning as well. And some staff from the IUPAT Local 10. And set up a picket line. And it was amazing. It was an amazing experience for the simple fact that the building trades were all there and they recognized the picket line immediately. And it was just a very historic moment. There was a gentleman there from, and he was like a third generation painter in our local. And he had been waiting for this for his entire career. And so anyway, he drove up from Astoria just to be there in the morning. And of course these things started, we started these things at 5:30 in the morning. So he made the trip. It was well worth it. And it was just an amazing event. And he was quite taken back by it. I think he may even have cheered up a bit.
When you say that the other building trades recognize the picket line.
In most, I think all construction building trades, CBAs or collective bargaining agreements, they have the right to honor a picket line. So when they see a picket line up, they can decide to go ahead and turn away and respect that line and go ahead and turn away and either go back home or be reassigned to a different project. It's one of the most important things I think that we have in our CBAs besides the grievance procedure. Is that right to respect a picket line?
So 40 years without a strike, and now you're talking about a summer of chaos. So what brought you to this point?
So the summer of chaos was essentially is that we went into bargaining, and during the bargaining, the contractors had told us that, hey, like there's not much work coming up, everything's unstable, and they were really more talking about the unstable environment ahead of them. And so we simply made an information request from them and said, hey, if things are unstable, tell us all of the jobs that you have lined up, and we call it jobs in the pipeline. And typically in the industry, we say you have 6 months or 12 months. And if you have 12 months in the pipeline, like you're doing really well. And if you have 18, you're in a boom like recently. And so we just wanted to have an idea for bargaining. What does that look like to you? And so maybe we can adjust our expectations from that. And three of the contractors, and we asked them individually, three of them refused to give us the information. And that is some basic information that we're entitled to. And so with that, we filed an unfair labor practice, usually called an ULP, with the board. And then with that ULP, then you can go out on a picket. And basically, you're in protest of the unfair labor practice at that moment.
We've been talking with Scott Oldham of the Painters District Council 5. Thank you, Scott, for coming on Labor Radio.
Thank you for having me. This is great.
Right. Thanks, Scott.
I'm Jamie Partridge with Laura Wadlin. Stay tuned for Prison Pipeline.
Baby, you understand me now.
And now, here's your next episode of My Labor Radio.
Right, welcome back, folks, to My Labor Radio. We're reviewing the American Rescue Plan. It's a statewide tour put on by the Democratic Party to remind everybody how much money came to the state. $5.8 billion with a B. $2 billion went to the schools, $250 million just to expand broadband in the state. Now, I broke it down just a bit before the break as to what each county is going to get, but there are individual events going on every week. Several nights a week, there's going to be an individual event in our Northeast Indiana district. You're listening to this now. It's already happened in several places. In early June, I was with the Democrats from Huntington County, and we had one of those events. It was a Saturday in the afternoon, and this event was attended by quite a few great people. I got a chance to sit with and hang out with Nicole Bolden. Now, she's the elected city clerk in Bloomington, Indiana, and she's also a member of the Indiana League of Municipal Clerks and Treasurers. Now, she's the Indiana Democratic Party Deputy Chair for Cities and Towns. So it's incumbent on her to make sure that cities and towns hear what this dollar amount is. Now, this event, attended by over 50 people, was an opportunity to really let folks know what's going on. So there were some media folks there too, so they could push that out later into the Huntington area, so Huntington County residents could understand what kind of money was brought to their area. So as the event unfolded and started, our Huntington County host, in this case, Christine Bohm, introduces Nicole Bolden to come up and give a speech as we kick the whole thing off to learn more about the American Rescue Plan. Here's Nicole Bolden.
Hello, how are you all today? Thank you so much for having me here. As Christine said, my name is Nicole Bolden. I'm the Bloomington City Clerk, and today I am here because I am the Deputy Chair for Cities and Towns. And I am so excited to be here, and it's great. I think this is the first time I've been out at a barbecue of any sort in over a year, almost 2 years now, right? And we got here today because hopefully we're all vaccinated, so we're not wearing masks. And we're able to start getting out again, which is the point, right? The point is to get out again. And that is part of what the American Rescue Plan is about. Now, I know that, what was it, over 91% of all Hoosiers got the stimulus checks, right? Everybody's happy about the stimulus checks. We all cashed our checks. You know, I got one, family members got them, friends, everybody else. But it's not just about that. So all of our counties got money. Our cities are getting money, our school boards are getting money. This area alone got over $16 million. I mean, these are real dollars. This is not chump change. And every political body, every subdivision is able to decide how they're going to spend that money. So at this point, we need to help them. They need our help. We need to start showing up. So we're gonna go to the meetings, and I don't know when the next county council meeting is. I don't know when the next school board meeting is in Huntington County, but I know that we can show up. I know that we can hold them accountable. And I know that we can do so as Democrats, or we can just do so as good neighbors. We can go next door and say, hey, you know what? I've got some free time. And maybe we can go over to the school board and talk to them about what our teachers need in the classroom, right? And I know that when I was driving up from Bloomington and I hit Indianapolis, or when I'm driving on those streets and I hit pothole after pothole after pothole, potholes are not Republicans. Potholes are not Democrats. They have no party. But we can talk to our officials and say, you know what, we need to fill these. And that's what those ARPA funds can be used for. So let's not spend the money on dumb stuff. Instead, we can talk to them and say, we need to spend these dollars in real ways. And we have the money to do it now. This is the second biggest thing since the New Deal, right? So why not do it? This is the time. This is what we are here for. We are all Democrats. We know our neighbors. This is not a partisan issue. This is about taking care of one another. So let's reach out. This is why we're here. This is what the money is for. We have an opportunity now like we have not had in a generation, two generations. You know what? History is not my major. So reach out, talk to your neighbors, talk to your coworkers. Do it as a Democrat. Do it as a good friend. Heck, just do it for me.
So that was the voice of Nicole Bolden.
Thanks for listening. Remember, take care of each other at work. You know the boss won't do it.
Listening to the Valley Labor Report with David Story and Jacob Morrison.
It's something that is leveraged, and I think it's something that's being leveraged right now in the next fight we had to talk about.
That's exactly right. The next fight, and it transitions so well because this is the kind of thing that in this next fight that they're using is the warm fuzzies, is the prestige. This is something that the New Yorker said in their fight against their staff union after 2.5 years of contract negotiation. But the thing that we wanted to talk about today was a staff for the editorial staff for MSNBC is unionizing. And now here's one thing that I hope is that maybe if they get a union that their programming will be more watchable.
Yeah, hopefully staff will be unionized and their channel will suck a whole lot less.
Yeah, yeah.
Fingers crossed because that stuff is toxic.
Yes, we're crossing our fingers. But look, even if they're still made to make toxic stuff for their bosses, because of course it's still the people who are going to be ultimately controlling the agenda is going to be the bosses and the corporations. And this is what we see in this fight against the union. These workers are trying to create a better life for themselves at MSNBC as workers, as people who do the copy editing, as people who make sure that the grammar is right, as people who make sure that the try probably against the wishes of some of the on-air personalities, try to make sure that they have their facts straight, who want to make a difference. They want to have they want to be able to have a good life. They want to be able to afford an apartment in New York or D.C. or wherever they are. And so they have formed a union. They have requested voluntary recognition after showing that a majority of their staff support the union and support unionizing. They want to be a union, and their staff and their management at MSNBC. This is supposed to be liberal, lefty, socialist news.
I mean,
that was my understanding.
On this station, they would make it out like MSNBC is Pravda, you know, from the Soviet Union.
That was my understanding, is that MSNBC was supposed to be like News Nightly or something. And so you would think that these people in management there, if they are actually socialist or left-wing or liberal and they care about workers, that when their own workers say that we want to unionize, and when they express a majority Democratic support for this initiative, and in an industry where voluntary recognition is the industry standard... That is the industry standard in media right now. There have been so many unions formed in the media industry, and they have almost all been voluntarily recognized by their management. This is it. Just not even just, oh, like these are just lefty outlets. It's just like regular newsrooms voluntarily recognize their staff unions. This is just I said it over and over, but I want people to understand this is the industry standard, is voluntary recognition. When a majority of your employees in the media industry tell you they are union, then management has, in contemporary America, the industry standard is to recognize that. And MSNBC has refused to do that. They have refused to do just the bare minimum and give their employees respect as adults, as people who are supposed to sift through the news and make decisions. They have refused to accept that their workers are adults and know what they're doing and want to unionize. And so they have said, we refuse voluntary recognition. We're going to go through the NLRB election process, which is going to give us time to fill our workers' heads with implicit threats, with lies, with misrepresentations, and exactly like we were talking about before, and a much more explicit example of what we talked about with Paul Prescott a few weeks ago is this woke washing of their mission and what they're doing and their status as a workplace.
You're listening to En Masse, bringing you stories of struggle and hope from the working class. I'm your host, Liz Medina. In this episode, Professor Robert Ovetz and I will discuss case studies of working class struggle from around the world that he's collected in a new book published by Pluto Press called Workers' Inquiry and Global Class Struggle: Strategies, Tactics, Objectives. Welcome, Professor Robert Ovetz.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So, can you explain for those of us who may not be familiar, what is a workers' inquiry?
So a workers' inquiry is something that was originally coined by Karl Marx. It was picked up starting in the 1950s at the same time by a French group and an Italian group. They started working with workers who were trying to organize, engage in various struggles, and they tried to understand how workers are organized and reorganized by the boss through various management strategies, and then how workers overcome those divisions and the internal hierarchies in order to what I call recompose their struggle. And the one other thing that's important about a workers' inquiry is that it's the methodology for understanding what's called class composition of capital. So how does capital organize the workplace? In other words, how's work organized? What are the rules and the hierarchies in work? What are the types of technologies? Why are they being introduced? How do they control and shape the way that we work? So by understanding how work is organized, workers can then understand why the technical composition was changed in order to decompose workers' power. In other words, how was management strategy introduced to defeat workers' previous cycles of struggle? So if there was a strike, in response to that strike, capital comes in, introduces new technologies, new management strategies, it outsources or insources, it creates new job categories, right? So by understanding the technical composition and how it was used to decompose workers' struggle, workers, using a workers' inquiry, can then figure out how to recompose their struggle by developing new tactics and strategies.
Can you like maybe talk a little bit about how fighting racism and sexism in Po Valley was, you know, a way for them to actually build unity and worker power in the workplace?
In this one company in Italy, had a workforce that was primarily composed of immigrant women workers, and they had been divided based on what country they were from and various language barriers. And to overcome that, Anna worked with a core group of worker organizers in that warehouse to reach across those different boundaries and be able to make connections with other groups of workers who were not really coordinated with each other and were actually in some ways in conflict with one another. And they eventually went on strike and they achieved national attention and they eventually won their strike and changed the company's policies that prevented them from pitting workers, particularly men and women from different countries and ethnicities against each other.
At the end of your book, you talk about the need for a global workers' inquiry. Why do we need a global workers' inquiry and how can rank and file workers help to build one?
There is some of this going on, and one of the webinars that I organized, we had this extraordinary exchange between Amazon workers in New York, Chicago, Spain, Italy, and Poland. And what appears to be going on is that these Amazon workers are carrying out their own inquiries, and they're informing their tactics and strategies at the local level and regional levels in these different countries and coordinating their efforts with one another. So they're taking simultaneous action in two continents among a number of different countries against the world's largest company. And that's why a global workers' inquiry is needed, so that what is happening inside of Amazon can be amplified and replicated through all the different sectors of the capitalist economy. Because the reality is that capital is organized globally and it's coordinated, although there's internal divisions and fights between different companies and so forth. The working class is not anywhere near organized globally. And until we do that, and a global workers' inquiry can be one of the methods for doing that, we're going to continue to get our asses kicked. And we know we're getting our asses kicked, but we need a global strategy to match a global economic system that we're fighting.
Wonderful. I just want to thank you again for taking the time today and for editing this phenomenal book. It was empowering to read. I strongly encourage all my listeners to pick up a copy. They can order it online. It's a Workers' Inquiry and Global Class Struggle by Professor Robert Ovetz.
Welcome to the BCTGM Voices Project, a podcast highlighting the real people who make up our union, the bakery, confectionery, tobacco workers, and grain millers. I'm Michelle Ellis, Director of Digital Media. I will bring the work of our union to you through monthly interviews with the BCTGM's hardworking leaders, organizers, and everyday members. This is the BCTGM Voices Project. I first met Andrew Gutierrez, the president of BCTGM Local 351 in Albuquerque, New Mexico, in 2018 when I was assembling a social media panel for the union's 40th Constitutional Convention. Local 351 caught our attention several years ago when we started seeing really valuable union content on their social media feeds. How to spot the union label on the grocery store shelves, shouting out their members for products they make in the local community, things like that. I thought Andrew could offer some of his strategies in a small breakout group, and he didn't disappoint. Andrew is super passionate about this union and also serves as a vice president in the New Mexico Federation of Labor. He's a true leader with a heart for activism and service to his members.
So you work at Bimbo Bakeries, right?
Correct.
Okay, so how long have you been working there, and then how did it come upon you that you were going to become a shop?
I've been inside the factory for 8 years now, and I probably became a steward within a year of being hired. I actually saw a flyer in the union bulletin board about a union meeting, and the language on the flyer specifically caught my attention. It said, "This is your union," and I didn't really know that I was, at the time, that I was even part of the union. I didn't really know what that meant, and although I was paying dues. And so I went to a meeting just to see where my dues were going, what this thing that was mine. I showed up out of the blue, and a lot of the people didn't really even know who I was, but I was able to verify that I was a member, and I loved it right away. The way they were so concerned with the members, the employees and their rights, and I just knew right then and there that I wanted to be a part of it. And so went to a few more meetings, and they quickly, swooped me up and started training me. And they also saw the passion and the interest and started grooming,
Yeah, that's cool. So you're a shop steward for how long?
Technically, I'm still a shop steward. But before I was an officer, I was a shop steward for maybe 3 years, I bet.
Okay. And then VP.
And I became the vice president, correct.
Okay. And then you mentioned Earl Reed. We should give a shout out to him because
correct. So Earl was also part of my grooming and my training, and he was the president and business manager at the time, and when I served as the vice president, which is how I started getting more involved with the international side and realizing that I had something when I wanted to pursue that. And he saw that, and then he retired, and I ran for office, and I won my election. I did run opposed. This was a good race, but I did win that election, and here we are. And I just got reelected for my second term now.
Good. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Anybody that has been paying attention all along the way here, we did interview President Shelton last month, and he laid out the case then that his tenure here as the international president is going to be really focused in on serving the membership. And this is something that you do really well. So I do want to make sure that we talk a little bit about that, like your vision of what it means to lead a local union.
Well, I feel like sometimes as we rise in the ranks a little bit, we could get disconnected, I feel like, from the membership or from the workers, especially if you move out of the factory and you're working out of the union hall full time. I've been to bigger union functions where the union officers are wearing suits and ties and stuff. And I've never owned a suit in my life. I wear jeans and boots. And I kind of could see, again, it's not intentional and it's kind of inevitable in some cases, but I could see the disconnection already from kind of that working class mentality. And I think the fact that I still work in the factory, it helps maintain that and it's easier to service the members when you're working right next to them on the factory floor. But yes, I would agree with President Shelton, though, servicing the members, that's our bread and butter. And if the members feel like they're not involved or not being heard, then they start to distance and that's up to our.
All right, that's all I've got then for today. Thank you again.
Thank you.
Touch.
Welcome to another edition of On the Line, a podcast that aims to shine light on British Columbia's rich labor heritage. I'm your host, Rod Mickleborough. June is Indigenous History Month in Canada. This edition of On the Line takes note of Indigenous History Month with a different aspect of BC's Indigenous history. We examine the contribution of Indigenous workers to operations of the Port of Vancouver, particularly in the first half of the 20th century. I think it's safe to say that not many British Columbians are aware that until the last years of the 19th century, a large part of BC's early workforce was Indigenous. Yet their role in building BC's early economy has been written out of the history books. Indigenous workers excelled on the waterfront, the back-breaking physical work of loading and unloading ships. Members of the Squamish and Tsleil-Waututh nations became particularly adept at loading lumber, a job that required both skill and muscle power. In the words of Ed Long, who began longshoring early in the 20th century, they were the greatest men that ever worked the lumber. Those early Indigenous longshoremen stood up for each other. In 1906, they formed one of the first unions on the Vancouver waterfront. Not only that, their Lumber Handlers Union was one of the first unions in BC to join the newly formed Industrial Workers of the World. The IWW, or Wobblies, as they were often called, were the most militant, radical union organization North America had ever seen. Their goal was to overthrow capitalism and replace it with egalitarian socialism. Most of its 50 or 60 members were Indigenous. It is probably safe to assume that they were drawn to its policy of racial equality. Most unions in those days closed the door to non-white workers, believing that the lower wages they usually received undercut their own wages. But the IWW was open to all workers, regardless of race. Class was the enemy, the Wobblies proclaimed, not race. The union quickly became known on the docks as the Bows and Arrows. However, in 1923, a disastrous strike wiped out unionization on the waterfront. Most strikers were blacklisted, including Indigenous workers. Yet a number eventually found themselves back on the job, and the Bows and Arrows appeared once again as the International Lumber Handlers Association. During this time, the Bows and Arrows pioneered the use of waterfront gangs. But the Depression, mergers, and the bitter six-month waterfront strike in 1935 brought an end to the wonderful Bows and Arrows. Still, the waterfront continued to employ large numbers of Indigenous workers well into the 1950s. Ken Baker points out that he did a lot more than just physical labor. He also touches on the dangers of the job and how he got into longshoring in the first place.
Anyways, I was in a Teddy Band gang, native Squamish. Then I moved to the board, dispatching every day. From there, I went driving winch, lift truck, bulldozer, all the machinery you can get a hold of in the waterfront. I did that. My dad was down there, my uncles were down there. My uncle got killed on the waterfront. He fell off a gangplank, and he was paralyzed for the rest of his life. And Uncle Joe had a gang, Uncle Joe Baker. That was another Native gang. But my dad got me in the waterfront. I'll never forget that day. It was a cold autumn day like today. He's working on CPR. Was throwing it in these steel skiffs. And I said, but this is longshore and I'm getting the hell out of here. They give me a shovel. And you fill these skiffs up, take them down below and put them on the side cars, outside the railway cars. But I seen my check the next week. I said, I think I'll go back.
The story of Indigenous waterfront workers and the bows and arrows is one of the best. We hope we have done it justice. I'm your host, Rod Mickleborough. We'll see you next time on The Line. Reinforcements now appearing, victory is nigh.
Victory will come. It's time for The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is The Rick Smith Show.
Today I'm speaking with Rick Smith of The Rick Smith Show. Rick, tell me a little bit about yourself, where you grew up, and what led you to organized labor.
How I got to radio is, you know, one of, by accident, just fell into it. You know, I grew up as a kid in the housing project on the west side of Cleveland. Basically, I was the white kid in the ghetto, a minority in a minority neighborhood. And you know, how I came to labor was I saw people's lives get better. I think of the one neighbor we had. He got a job at Ford. He was a UAW member. And immediately their lives got better. The kids got secondhand bikes. They got better clothes. They got a used car. They had food at the end of the month. And then eventually they moved out. Their lives got better. And for me, the message at a very young age was union equals better life. You work hard, you play by the rules. As my mother always said, you get ahead. And that progression was important and something that was reinforced when I was a kid. So when I couldn't afford to go to college anymore, I was fortunate enough to get a good union job. I've spent 33 years carrying a union card. The Teamsters, the vast majority of it. And, you know, the reality is one of the things I talk about on my show quite often is that ability to have a voice in where you spend the mass of your life. That empowerment, that contract, and knowing that someone has your back. And I think that's what we've lost a lot of in this country, that sense of that we have some control. And that's why I think, you know, unions are a vital part of what goes on these days.
For those who may not be interested or aware of labor news, why do you think unions and organized labor are important and why do you cover them?
It comes back to something my high school government teacher said. I said, look, at the end of the day, politics is about who gets what. It's the same thing about labor unions. It's about who gets what slice of the pie, who gets the say in your hours, wages, conditions, who has say in what you endure in those hours that you spend at work. And major newspapers had labor reporters who would focus on the labor beat, and they would talk about, you know, the strikes that were going on, the contract negotiations that were going on. And, oh, by the way, they would talk about the wages, hours, conditions. There isn't a newspaper in this country that's got a labor page anymore. Every one of them got a business page. Every one of them's telling you how wonderful Wall Street's doing, how wonderful the CEOs are doing, how wonderful the shareholders are doing. And you know why they're doing so well? Because they're taken from the employees. There was just a great study done by the Pew Research Center that came out and said over the last 45 years, we the working people have been robbed to the tune of about $2.5 trillion a year. You want to talk about massive redistribution of wealth? That's it right there in practice. We're being robbed at every turn and we don't even know about it because our news media doesn't focus on it at all. So the people who listen to my show and other shows on the Labor Radio Podcast Network, maybe you're going to get a little bit of that. And the more we talk to each other and the more we start talking about why it's important to get better wages, hours, and conditions, why it's important that we share in the wealth that our labor creates, maybe we'll start doing it.
You launched it in 2005. Can you talk about that process of starting your own show and what type of guests you're bringing on as well?
Well, I moved to Central Pennsylvania, where all of my Teamster buddies were talking about how the union wasn't doing us any good, how we'd make more money if there were no union here. And they were basically spouting, you know, the Limbaughs, the Hannitys, you know, all down the list, because it's what they were hearing. So it was my goal, my hope, to add some bit of balance. Because you go across this country, talk radio is dominated overwhelmingly by conservative voices. 90% of all talk radio was conservative. Truth be told, they've bought it up. They invested in the infrastructure and they own the medium. So it was my thought is, hey, how can I add a little balance? So I, along with a couple of other friends, said, let's start something. So we started on a Sunday afternoon on one local radio station, you know, just for an hour on Sunday talking about labor and economic issues. And that's grown to now we do 2 hours every night. We do a nationwide TV show, now on 20 stations across the country and all these platforms, and grown more than I could have ever imagined. But it still needs to be more, and we still need to expand, because look, at the end of the day, the conservative message dominates, the corporate message dominates. And what the corporate message keeps telling us is, don't ask for too much, just be happy you got a job.
Rick Smith, thank you for all the work you're doing, and I look forward to working with you in the struggle and see you in the trenches.
Good stuff, brother. Appreciate it.
We've reached the end of this edition of the Labour Radio Podcast Weekly, our weekly roundup of highlights from the Labour Radio Podcast Network. I hope it flew by quicker than a 4-mile freight train at a railroad crossing. If you're having a cookout this weekend, tell your friends about us. They can find links to all the network shows at labourradionetwork.org, including complete versions of the shows you heard today. And you can also find them by using the hashtag LabourRadioPod on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. Labour Radio Podcast Weekly was edited by Mel Smith and myself, produced by Chris Garland. Howard Phillips is our maestro of social media. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Labour Radio Net. Find out more on our website at labourradionetwork.org. For Labour Radio Podcast Weekly, this is Patrick Dixon. Hope to see you next time.